Clipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of Fractured by Karen Slaughter, narrated by George Guidel, and directed by Greta Cohn.
Prologue. Abigail Campano sat in her car, parked on the street outside her own house. She was looking up at the mansion they had remodeled almost 10 years ago. The house was huge. Too much space for three people, especially since one of them, God willing, would be going off to college in less than a year. What would she do with herself once her daughter was busy starting a new life of her own? It would be Abigail and Paul again, just like before Emma was born. The thought made her stomach clench. Paul's voice crackled through the car speakers as he came back on the telephone. "Babe, listen," he began, but her mind was already wandering as she stared up at the house. When had her life gotten so small? When had the most pressing questions of her day turned into concerns about other people, other things? Were Paul's shirts ready at the tailor? Did Emma have volleyball practice tonight? Did the decorator order the new desk for the office? Did somebody remember to let out the dog, or was she going to spend the next 20 minutes wiping up 2 gallons of pee off the kitchen floor? Abigail swallowed, her throat tightening. "I don't think you're listening to me," Paul said. "I'm listening." She turned off the car. There was a click. Then, through the magic of technology, Paul's voice transferred from the car speakers to the cell phone. Abigail pushed open the door, tossing her keys into her purse. She cradled the phone to her ear as she checked the mailbox. Electric bill, Amex, Emma's school fees. Paul paused for a breath, and she took that as her cue. "If she doesn't mean anything to you, why did you give her a car? Why did you take her to a place where you knew my friends might show up?" Abigail said the words as she walked up the driveway, but she didn't feel them deep in her gut like she had the first few times this had happened. Her only question then had been, "Why am I not enough?" Now her only question was, "Why are you such a needy bastard?" "I just needed a break," he told her, another old standard. She dug her hand into her purse for her keys as she climbed the porch stairs. She had left the club because of him, skipped her weekly massage and lunch with her closest friends because she was mortified that they had all seen Paul out with some bottle blonde 20-year-old he'd had the gall to take to their favorite restaurant. She didn't know if she would ever be able to show her face there again. Abigail said, "I'd like a break too, Paul. How would you like it if I took a break? How would you like it if you were talking to your friends one day and you knew something was going on and you had to practically beg them to tell you what was wrong before they finally told you that they saw me with another man? I'd find out his fucking name and I'd go to his house and I'd kill him." Why did part of her always feel flattered when he said things like that? As the mother of a teenage girl, she had trained herself to look for the positive aspects of even the most savage remarks. But this was ridiculous. Besides, Paul's knees were so bad that he could barely take the garbage down to the curb on trash day. The biggest shock in all of this should have been that he could still find a 20-year-old to screw him. Abigail slid her key into the old metal lock on the front door. The hinges squeaked like in a horror movie. The door was already open. "Wait a minute," she said, as if interrupting, though Paul hadn't been talking. "The front door is open."
"What?"
He hadn't been listening to her either. "I said the front door is already open," she repeated, pushing it open wider.
"Ah, Jesus, school's only been back for 3 weeks and she's already skipping again?"
"Maybe the cleaners..." She stopped, her foot crunching glass. Abigail looked down, feeling a sharp, cold panic building somewhere at the base of her spine. "There's glass all over the floor. I just stepped in it." Paul said something she didn't hear. "Okay," Abigail answered, automatic. She turned around. One of the tall side windows by the front door was broken. Her mind flashed on a hand reaching in, unlatching the bolt, opening the door. She shook her head. In broad daylight? In this neighborhood? They couldn't have more than 3 people over at a time without the batty old woman across the street calling to complain about the noise.
Abby?
She was in some kind of bubble, her hearing muffled. She told her husband,
I think someone broke in.
Paul barked,
Get out of the house! They could still be there!
She dropped the mail onto the hall table, catching her reflection in the mirror. She'd been playing tennis for the last 2 hours. Her hair was still damp, stray wisps plastered to the back of her neck where her ponytail was starting to come loose. The house was cool, but she was sweating.
Abby! Paul yelled. Get out right now! I'm calling the police on the other line!
She turned, mouth open, to say something. What? When she saw the bloody footprint on the floor.
Emma,
she whispered, dropping the phone as she bolted up the stairs toward her daughter's bedroom. She stopped at the top of the stairs, shocked at the broken furniture, the splintered glass on the floor. Her vision tunneled, and she saw Emma lying in a bloody heap at the end of the hallway. A man stood over her, a knife in his hand. For a few seconds, Abigail was too stunned to move, her breath catching, throat closing. The man started toward her. Her eyes couldn't focus on any one thing. They went back and forth between the knife clenched in his bloody fist and her daughter's body on the floor.
No!
The man lunged toward her. Without thinking, Abigail stepped back. She tripped, falling down the stairs, hip and shoulder blades thumping the hard wood as she slid headfirst. There was a chorus of pain from her body, elbow hitting the stiles on the railing, ankle bone cracking against the wall, a searing burn in her neck as she tried to keep her head from popping against the sharp tread of the stairs. She landed in the foyer, the breath knocked out of her lungs.
The dog. Where was the stupid dog?
Abigail rolled onto her back, wiping blood out of her eyes, feeling broken glass grind into her scalp. The man was rushing down the stairs, the knife still in his hand. Abigail didn't think. She kicked up as he came off the last tread, lodging the toe of her sneaker somewhere between his asshole and his scrotum. She was far off the mark, but it didn't matter. The man stumbled, cursing as he went down on one knee. She rolled onto her stomach and scrambled toward the door. He grabbed her leg, yanking her back so hard that a white-hot pain shot up her spine and into her shoulder. She clutched at the glass on the floor, trying to find a piece to hurt him with, but the tiny shards only ripped open the skin of her hand. She started kicking at him, legs flailing wildly behind her as she inched toward the front door.
Stop it!
He screamed, both his hands clamping down on her ankles.
God damn it, I said stop!
She stopped, trying to catch her breath, trying to think. Her head was still ringing, her mind unable to focus. 2 feet ahead, the front door was still open, offering a view down the gentle slope of the walk to her car parked on the street. She twisted around so she could face her attacker. He was on his knees, holding her ankles to keep her from kicking. The knife was beside him on the floor. His eyes were a sinister black, 2 pieces of granite showing beneath heavy lids. His broad chest rose and fell as he panted for breath. Blood soaked his shirt. Emma's blood. Abigail tensed her stomach muscles and lunged up toward him, fingers straight out as her nails stabbed into his eyes. He slapped the side of her ear with his open palm, but she kept at it, digging her thumbs into his eye sockets, feeling them start to give. His hands clamped around her wrists, forcing her fingers away. He was 20 times stronger than her, but Abigail was thinking only of Emma now. That split second when she'd seen her daughter upstairs, the way her body was positioned, her shirt pushed up over her small breasts. She was barely recognizable, her head a bloody red mass. He had taken everything, even her daughter's beautiful face.
You bastard!
Abigail screamed, feeling like her arms were going to break as he pried her hands away from his eyes. She bit his fingers until teeth met with bone. The man screamed, but still held on. This time, when Abigail brought up her knee, it made contact squarely between his legs. The man's bloody eyes went wide, and his mouth opened, releasing a huff of sour breath. His grip loosened, but still did not release. As he fell onto his back, he pulled Abigail along with him. Automatically, her hands wrapped around his thick neck. She could feel the cartilage in his throat move, the rings that lined the esophagus bending like soft plastic. His grip went tighter around her wrists, but her elbows were locked now, her shoulders in line with her hands, as she pressed all of her weight into the man's neck. Lightning bolts of pain shot through her shaking arms and shoulders, her hands cramped, as if thousands of tiny needles stabbed into her nerves. She could feel vibrations through her palms as he tried to speak. Her vision tunneled again. She saw starbursts of red dotting his eyes, his wet lips opening, tongue protruding. She was sitting on him, straddling him, and she became aware of the fact that she could feel the man's hip bones pressing into the meat of her thighs as he arched up trying to buck her off. Unbidden, she thought of Paul, the night they had made Emma. How Abigail had known, just known, that they were making a baby. She had straddled her husband like this,
wanting to make sure she got every drop of him to make their perfect child. And Emma was perfect. Her sweet smile, her open face, the way she trusted everyone she met no matter how many times Paul warned her. Emma lying upstairs, dead, blood pooled around her, underwear yanked down, her poor baby. What had she gone through? What humiliation had she suffered at the hands of this man? Abigail felt a sudden warmness between her legs. The man had urinated on them both. He stared at her, really saw her. Then his eyes glassed over. His arms fell to the sides, hands popping against the glass-strewn tile. His body went limp, mouth gaping open. Abigail sat back on her heels, looking at the lifeless man in front of her. She had killed him. Day 1. Chapter 1. Will Trent stared out the window of the car as he listened to his boss yell into her cell phone. Not that Amanda Wagner ever really raised her voice, but she had a certain edge to her tone that had caused more than one of her agents to burst into tears and walk off an active investigation. No mean feat, considering the majority of her subordinates at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation were men. "We're at," she craned her neck, squinting at the street sign, "the Prado and 17th. Amanda paused. "Perhaps you could look up the information on your computer?" She shook her head, obviously not liking what she was hearing. Will tried. "Maybe we should keep driving around. We might find..." Amanda covered her eyes with her hand. She whispered into the phone, "How long until the server is back up?" The answer caused her to breathe out a heavy, pronounced sigh. Will indicated the screen dominating the middle of the wood-lined dashboard. The Lexus had more bells and whistles than a clown's hat. "Don't you have GPS?" She dropped her hand, considering his question, then began fiddling with some knobs on the dashboard. The screen didn't change, but the air conditioning whirred higher. Will chuckled, and she cut him off with a nasty look, suggesting, "Maybe while we're waiting for Caroline to find a street map, you can get the owner's manual out of the glove box and read the directions for me?" Will tried the latch, but it was locked. He thought this pretty much summed up his relationship with Amanda Wagner. She often sent him the way of locked doors and expected him to find his way around them. Will liked a good puzzle as much as the next man, but just once it would have been nice to have Amanda hand him the key. Or maybe not. Will had never been good at asking for help, especially from someone like Amanda, who seemed to keep a running list in her head of people who owed her favors. He looked out the window as she berated her secretary for not keeping a street map on her person at all times. Will had been born and raised in Atlanta, but didn't often find himself in Ansley Park. He knew that it was one of the city's oldest and wealthiest neighborhoods, where over a century ago, lawyers, doctors, and bankers had built their enviable estates so that future lawyers, doctors, and bankers could live as they did, safely cloistered in the middle of one of the most violent metropolitan cities this side of the Mason-Dixon. The only thing that had changed over the years was that the black women pushing white babies in strollers were better compensated these days. With its twisting turns and roundabouts, Ansley seemed designed to confuse, if not discourage, visitors. Most of the streets were tree-lined, broad avenues with the houses tucked up on hills to better look down on the world. Densely forested parks with walking trails and swing sets were everywhere. Some of the walkways were still the original cobblestone. Though all the homes were architecturally different, there was a certain uniformity to their crisply painted exteriors and professionally landscaped lawns. Will guessed this was because even a fixer-upper started at the 1 million mark. Unlike his own Ponce Highland neighborhood, which was less than 6 miles from here, there were no rainbow-colored houses or methadone clinics in Ansley. On the street, Will watched a jogger stop to stretch and surreptitiously check out Amanda's Lexus. According to the news this morning, there was a code red smog alert in effect, advising people not to breathe the outside air unless they absolutely had to. No one seemed to be taking that to heart, even as the temperature inched past the 100 mark. Will had seen at least 5 joggers since they'd entered Ansley Park. All were women, and all so far had fit the stereotype of the perky, perfect soccer mom with their Pilates-toned bodies and bouncy ponytails. The Lexus was parked at the bottom of what seemed to be a popular hill, the street behind them lined with tall oaks that cast the pavement into shadow. All of the runners had slowed to look at the car. This wasn't the type of neighborhood where a man and a woman could sit in a parked vehicle for very long without someone calling the police. Of course, this wasn't the kind of neighborhood where teenage girls were brutally raped and murdered in their own homes, either. He glanced back at Amanda, who was holding the phone to her ear so tightly it looked as if she might snap the plastic in two. She was an attractive woman, if you never heard her speak, or had to work for her or sit in a car with her for any length of time. She had to be in her early 60s by now. When Will had first started at the GBI over 10 years ago, Amanda's hair had been more pepper than salt, but that had changed drastically over the last few months. He didn't know if this was because of something in her personal life or an inability to get an appointment with her hairdresser, but she had lately begun showing her years. Amanda started pressing buttons on the console again, obviously trying to work the GPS. The radio came on and she quickly turned it off again, but not before Will caught the opening notes of a swing band. She muttered something under her breath and pressed another button, which caused Will's window to slide down. He felt a blast of hot air like someone had opened an oven door. In the side mirror, he saw a jogger at the top of the hill, the leaves on the dogwoods stirring in the breeze. Amanda gave up on the electronics. "This is ridiculous. We're the top investigatory arm in the state, and we can't even find the goddamn crime scene." Will turned around, his seatbelt straining against his shoulder as he looked up the hill. Amanda asked, "What are you doing?" "That way," he said, pointing behind them. The limbs of the trees overhead were intertwined, casting the street in a dusk-like darkness. There was no breeze this time of year, just relentless heat. What he had seen was not rustling leaves, but the blue lights of a police cruiser bouncing off the shadows. Amanda gave another heavy sigh as she put the car into gear and started a U-turn. Without warning, she slammed on the brakes, her arm shooting out in front of Will as if she could stop him from going through the windshield. A large white van blared its horn as it sped by, the driver shaking his fist, mouthing obscenities. "Channel 5," Will said, recognizing the local news station's logo on the side of the van. "They're almost as late as we are," Amanda commented, following the news van up the hill. She took a right, coming on a lone police cruiser blocking the next left. A smattering of reporters was already at the scene, representing all the local stations as well as CNN, which had their world headquarters a few miles up the road. A woman strangling the man who had killed her daughter would be big news in any part of the world. But the fact that the daughter was white, that the parents were wealthy, and the family was one of the city's most influential, gave it an almost giddy, scandalous tinge. Somewhere in New York City, a Lifetime movie executive was drooling into her BlackBerry. Amanda pulled out her badge and waved it at the cop as she rolled past the blockade. There were more police cruisers up ahead, along with a couple of ambulances. The doors were open, the beds empty. Paramedics stood around, smoking. The Hunter Green BMW X5, parked in front of the house, seemed out of place among the emergency vehicles, but the gigantic SUV made Will wonder where the coroner's van was. He wouldn't be surprised if the medical examiner had gotten lost, too. Ansley was not a neighborhood well known to someone earning a civil servant's salary. Amanda put the car into reverse to parallel park between two of the cruisers. The park sensor controls started beeping as she tapped on the gas. "Don't dawdle in there, Will. We're not working the case unless we're taking it over." Will had heard some variation on this same theme at least twice since they had left City Hall. The dead girl's grandfather, Hoyt Bentley, was a billionaire developer who had made his share of enemies over the years. Depending on who you talked to, Bentley was either a scion of the city or a crony from way back, a sort of moneyed crook who made things happen behind the scenes without ever getting his hands dirty. Whichever version of the man's story was true, he had deep enough pockets to buy his share of political friends. Bentley had made one phone call to the governor, who had reached out to the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, who had in turn assigned Amanda the task of looking into the murder. If the killing had any markings of a professional hit, or hinted at something deeper than a simple assault and burglary gone wrong, then Amanda would make a phone call
and snatched the case away from the Atlanta Police Department faster than a toddler taking back a favorite toy. If this was just a random, everyday tragedy, then she would probably leave the explanations to Will while she tootled back to City Hall in her fancy car. Amanda put the gear into drive and inched forward. The gap between the beeps got furiously short as she edged closer to the police car. If Bentley's got someone mad enough to kill his granddaughter, this case goes to a whole new level. She sounded almost hopeful at the prospect. Will understood her excitement. Breaking this kind of case would be yet another feather in Amanda's cap. But Will hoped he never got to the point where he saw the death of a teenage girl as a career stepping stone. Though he wasn't sure what he should think of the dead man, either. He was a murderer, but he was also a victim. Considering Georgia's pro-death penalty stance, did it really matter that he had been strangled here in Ansley Park, rather than strapped to a gurney and given a lethal injection at Coastal State Prison? Will opened the door before Amanda put the car into park. The hot air hit him like a punch to the gut, his lungs temporarily straining in his chest. Then the humidity took over, and he wondered if this was what it felt like to have tuberculosis. Still, he put on his suit jacket, covering the paddle holster clipped to the back of his belt. Not for the first time, Will questioned the sanity of wearing a three-piece suit in the middle of August. Amanda seemed untouched by the heat as she joined Will. A group of uniformed policemen stood clustered at the bottom of the driveway, watching them walk across the street. Recognition dawned in their eyes, and Amanda warned Will, "I don't have to tell you that you're not exactly welcome by the Atlanta Police Department right now." "No," Will agreed. One of the cops in the circle made a point of spitting on the ground as they passed by. Another one settled on a more subtle raised middle finger. Will plastered a smile on his face and gave the officers a big thumbs up to let them all know there were no hard feelings. From her first day in office, Atlanta's mayor had pledged to weed out the corruption that ran unchecked during her predecessor's reign. Over the last few years, she'd been working closely with the GBI to open cases against the most blatant offenders. Amanda had graciously volunteered Will to go into the lion's den. 6 months ago, he had closed an investigation that had resulted in the firing of 6 Atlanta police detectives and forced the early retirement of one of the city's highest-ranking officers. The cases were good. The cops were skimming cash off of narcotics busts, but nobody liked a stranger cleaning their house. And Will hadn't exactly made friends during the course of his investigation. Amanda had gotten a promotion out of it. Will had been turned into a pariah. He ignored the hissed asshole aimed at his back, trying to focus on the crime at hand as they walked up the curving driveway. The yard was brimming with all kinds of exotic-looking flowers that Will was hard-pressed to name. The house itself was enormous, stately columns holding up a second-floor balcony, a winding set of granite stairs leading to the front doors. Except for the smattering of surly cops marring the scene, it was an impressive estate. "Trent!" someone called, and he saw Detective Leo Donnelly making his way down the front steps. Leo was a short man, at least a full foot less than Will's 6'3". His gait had taken on an almost Columbo-like shuffle since they'd last worked together. The effect was that of an agitated monkey. "What the fuck are you doing here?" Will indicated the cameras, offering Leo the most believable explanation. Everybody knew the GBI would throw a baby into the Chattahoochee if it meant getting on the nightly news. He told the detective, "This is my boss, Dr. Wagner." "Hey," Leo said, tossing her a nod before turning back to Will. "How's Angie doing?" "We're engaged." Will felt Amanda's scrutiny focus on him with a cold intensity. He tried to deflect, indicating the open doorway with a nod of his head. "What have we got here?" "A shitload of hate for you, my friend." Leo took out a cigarette and lit it. "You better watch your back." Amanda asked, "Is the mother still inside?" "First door on the left," Leo answered. "My partner's in there with her." "Gentlemen, if you'll excuse me." Amanda dismissed Leo the way she might a servant. The look she gave Will wasn't that much more pleasant. Leo exhaled a line of smoke as he watched her go up the stairs. "Puts a chill on things, don't she? Like fucking dry ice." Will defended her automatically,
in that sort of way that you defend a useless uncle or slutty sister when someone outside of the family attacks them. Amanda is one of the best cops I've ever worked with. Leo fine-tuned his appraisal.
Nice ass for Grandma.
Will thought back to the car, the way Amanda's arm had shot out in front of him when she thought they were going to get hit by the news van. It was the most maternal thing he had ever seen her do. Leo offered,
Bet she's a lot of work in the sack.
Will tried not to shudder as he forced the image from his mind. How've you been?
Prostate's got me leaking like a fucking sieve. Haven't been laid in 2 months and I got this cough that won't go away.
He coughed as if to prove it, then took another hit off the cigarette.
You?
Will squared his shoulders. I can't complain.
Not with Angie Pulaski at home.
Leo's suggestive laugh reminded Will of what an asthmatic child molester would sound like if he smoked 3 packs a day. Angie had worked vice for 15 years before taking medical leave from the force. Leo was under the impression that she was a whore just because her job had required her to dress like one. Or maybe it was the many different men she'd slept with over the years. Will offered, I'll tell her you said hello.
Do that.
Leo stared up at Will, taking a deep pull on the cigarette.
What are you really doing here?
Will tried to shrug it off, knowing that Leo would be furious if he had his case snatched out from under him. Bentley's got a lot of connections. Leo dubiously raised an eyebrow. Despite the rumpled suit and the way his forehead sloped like a caveman's, he had been a cop long enough to recognize when someone hadn't exactly answered a question.
Bentley called you in?
The GBI can only involve itself in cases when it's invited by the local police force or government. Leo snorted a laugh, smoke coming out of his nostrils.
You left out kidnapping.
And bingo, Will added. The GBI had a task force that investigated bingo parlors in the state. It was the sort of job you got when you pissed off the wrong person. 2 years ago, Amanda had exiled Will to the North Georgia mountains, where he had spent his time arresting meth-dealing hillbillies and reflecting on the dangers of disobeying his direct superior. He didn't doubt a bingo transfer was in his future should he ever rile her again. Will indicated the house. What happened here?
The usual, Leo shrugged.
He took a long drag on his cigarette, then stubbed it out on his shoe.
Mom comes home from playing tennis, the door's open.
He put the butt in his jacket pocket as he led Will into the house.
She goes upstairs and sees her daughter dead and diddled.
He indicated the curving staircase that swept over their heads.
The killer's still here, sets his sights on the mom, who's fucking hot, by the way. Fighting ensues, and, surprise, he's the one that winds up dead.
Will studied the grand entranceway. The doors were a double set, one fixed, one open. The broken side window was a good distance from the knob. Someone would have to have a long arm to reach in and unlock the door. He asked, Any pets?
There's a 300-year-old yellow lab. He was in the backyard. Deaf as a freaking post, according to the mother. Probably slept through the whole thing.
How old was the girl?
17.
The number echoed in the tiled foyer with a smell of lavender air freshener, and Leo's sweaty nicotine stench competed alongside the metallic tinge of violent death. At the bottom of the stairs lay the source of the most dominant of all the odors. The man was lying on his back, with his hands palms up near his head as if in surrender. A medium-sized kitchen knife with a wooden handle and a jagged edge was a few feet from his hand, lying in a nest of broken glass. His black jeans looked soiled, the skin of his neck bruised red from strangulation. The smattering of a mustache under his nose made his lip look dirty. Acne spotted his sideburns. One of his sneakers had come untied, the laces stiff with dried blood. Incongruously, the killer's T-shirt had a dancing cherry on it, the stem cocked at a jaunty angle. The shirt was dark red, so it was hard to tell if the darker parts were blood, sweat, urine, or a combination of all three. Will followed the dead man's gaze up to the chandelier hovering overhead. The glass made a tinkling noise as it swayed in the artificial breeze from the air conditioning. White spots of light danced around the foyer, reflecting the sunlight that came in through the palladium window over the doors. Will asked,
Do you have an ID on him yet? Looks like his wallet's in his back pocket, but he's not going anywhere. I don't want to roll the body till Pete gets here. He meant Pete Hansen, the city medical examiner. Perp looks pretty young, you know. Yeah. Will agreed, thinking that the killer was probably not old enough to buy alcohol. Amanda had been excited by the prospect of a contract killing. Unless Hoyt Bentley's enemies had a crack team of mercenary frat boys on the payroll, Will doubted there was a connection. He asked, "Domestic?" Leo shrugged again, a gesture that was more like a tick. "Looks like it, huh? Boyfriend snaps, kills a girl, panics when the mom comes home and goes after her. Problem is, Campano swears she's never seen him before in her life." "Campano?" Will echoed, feeling his gut tighten at the name. "Abigail Campano, that's the mother." Leo stared at him. "You know her?" "No." Will looked down at the body, hoping his voice would not give him away. "I thought the last name was Bentley."
"That's the wife's father. The husband's Paul Campano. He owns a bunch of car dealerships. You heard the commercials, right? We never say no at Campano."
"Where is he?"
Leo's cell phone started to ring, and he slid it off the clip on his belt.
"Shouldn't be too much longer. He was on the phone with her when it happened. He's the one who called 911.
Will cleared his throat so his voice would come back. "Might be interesting to know what he heard."
"You think?"
He studied Will closely as he opened his cell phone, answering,
"Donnelly?"
Leo stepped outside, and Will looked around the foyer, taking in the dead body, the broken glass. Obviously, there had been a massive struggle here. Blood streaked the floor, two different sets of tennis shoes leaving smeared waffle prints across the creamy white tile. A frail, antique-looking table had fallen on its side, a glass bowl shattered beside it. There was a busted cell phone that looked as if it had been stepped on. Mail was scattered around like confetti, and a woman's handbag was overturned, the contents adding to the mess. Over by the wall there was a lamp sitting upright on the floor as if someone had placed it there. The base was cracked, and there was a tilt to the shade. Will wondered if someone had turned it right side up, or if the lamp, defying all probabilities, had landed upright. He also wondered if anyone had noticed the bloody bare footprint beside the lamp. His eyes followed the curving line of the polished wooden stairs, seeing two sets of bloody tennis shoe prints heading down, but no other bare footprints. There were scuffs and deep ruts in the walls where shoes and body parts had dug out the plaster, indicating at least one person had fallen. The trip must have been brutal. Abigail Campano had known she was fighting for her life. For his part, the dead kid at the bottom of the stairs was no lightweight. The definition of his muscles was evident under the red T-shirt. He must have been shocked to find himself overpowered even as he pulled his last breath. In his head, Will sketched a diagram of the house, trying to get his bearings. A long hallway under the stairs led to the back of the house and what looked like the kitchen and family room. There were two rooms off the front entrance, probably originally intended to be parlors, to give the men separate space from the women. Pocket doors closed off one room, but the second, which looked to be used as a library, was open. Dark paneling dominated the open parlor. Bookshelves lined the walls, and a fireplace with a deep hearth already had wood laid for a fire. The furniture was heavy, probably oak. Two large leather chairs dominated the space. Will assumed the other parlor was the opposite. The walls painted in white or cream, and the furnishings less masculine. Upstairs there would probably be the usual layout to these old houses, five or six bedrooms, connected by a long T-shaped hallway with what would have originally been servant stairs leading down to the kitchen in the back. If the other houses in the neighborhood were anything to go by, there would be a carriage house outside that had been converted to a garage with an apartment overhead. Measuring and mapping it all out for the reports would be a lot of work. Will was glad the task wouldn't fall to him. He was also glad he wouldn't have to explain why the single bloody footprint on the foyer was heading up the stairs instead of running out the front doorway. Leo came back into the house, obviously annoyed by the phone call. Like, I don't get enough people sticking their heads up my ass with this prostate thing.
He indicated the scene.
You solved this one for me yet?
Will asked. Who does the green BMW on the street belong to?
The mother.
What about the girl? Does she have a car?
A black Beamer, if you can believe it. 325 convertible. Parents took it away when her grades started to slide.
He pointed to the house across the street.
Nosy neighbor turned her in when she saw the car in the driveway during school hours.
Did the neighbor see anything today?
She's even older than the dog, so don't get your hopes up.
He gave a half shrug of his shoulder, allowing,
We've got somebody over there talking to her right now.
The mother's sure she doesn't recognize the killer?
Positive. I had her look at him again when she was more calmed down. Never seen him before in her life.
Will looked back at the dead man. Everything was adding up, but nothing made sense. How did he get here?
No idea. Could have taken the bus and walked from Peachtree Street. Peachtree, one of the busiest streets in Atlanta, was less than 10 minutes away. Buses and trains went back and forth over and underground, bringing thousands of people to the office buildings and shops along the strip. Will had heard of criminals doing more stupid things than timing a brutal murder around a bus schedule. But the explanation didn't feel right. This was Atlanta. Only the desperately poor or ecologically eccentric took public transportation. The man on the floor was a clean-cut white kid wearing what looked like a $300 pair of jeans and a $200 pair of Nikes. Either he had a car or he lived in the neighborhood. Leo offered,
We've got patrol out looking for a car that don't belong.
You were the first detective on the scene? Leo took his time answering, making sure Will knew that he was doing so as a courtesy.
I was the first cop, period, he finally said. 911 came in around 12:30. I was finishing lunch at that sandwich place on 14th. I got here maybe 2 seconds before the cruiser pulled up. We checked the house, made sure no one else was here, then I told everybody to get the hell out.
14th Street was less than a 5-minute drive from where they stood. It was luck that the first responding officer had been a detective who could secure the scene.
You were the first one to talk to the mother? She was freaked the fuck out, let me tell you. Hands were shaking, couldn't get her words out. Took about 10 minutes for her to calm down enough to get the story out.
So, this looks clean to you? Some kind of domestic violence scene between two teenagers, then the mom comes in and puts a kink in it?
Is that what Hoyt Bentley sent you to check out?
Will skirted the question.
This is a sensitive case, Leo. Bentley plays golf with the governor. He sits on the board of half the charities in town. Wouldn't you be more surprised if we weren't here?
Leo half shrugged, half nodded.
Maybe there was something bothering him about the scene, too, because he kept talking.
There's defensive wounds on the mother. You can see signs of the struggle. What with all the broken shit and the walls being bashed in? Dead kid's got more of the same, including some bite marks on his fingers where the mother tried to get his hands off her. The girl upstairs, he had some time with her. Panties down, bra pushed up, blood everywhere.
Was there a struggle upstairs?
Some, but not like down here.
He paused before offering,
You want to see her?
Will appreciated the gesture, but Amanda had made it more than clear that she didn't want him to get involved in this unless it had the markings of a professional hit. If Will saw something upstairs, no matter how innocuous, he might end up having to testify about it later in court. Still, she couldn't fault him for being curious. How was the girl killed?
Hard to tell.
Will glanced behind him at the open front door. The air conditioning in the house was on full blast, trying to keep up with the heat coming in. Did you already get pictures of everything in here?
Upstairs and down, Leo told him. We'll dust for prints and the usual shit once the bodies are taken away. By the way, that's when I'll shut the door, since you seem to have a stick up your ass about it. I'm trying to keep the tourists down to a minimum here. He added, case like this, there are going to be some heavy guns on it.
Will thought that was an understatement. No one had reported a strange car in the neighborhood. Unless Leo's public transportation theory held up, the kid was most likely a resident of Ansley Park. Knowing how these things worked, he probably came from a family of lawyers.
Leo would need to do everything exactly by the book or he'd end up dangling by his short hairs the minute he took the stand. Will rephrased his earlier question. How did she die?
She's a fucking mess. Face like raw hamburger, blood everywhere. I'm surprised the mother even recognized her.
Leo paused, obviously seeing Will wanted a more concrete answer.
My guess? He beat her, then stabbed her to death.
Again, Will looked at the dead man on the floor. His palms were covered with dried blood. Not what you would expect from a closed fist beating someone repeatedly, or, for that matter, a hand holding a knife. The knees of his black jeans looked dark, too, as if he had knelt in something wet. His t-shirt was bunched up just below his ribs. A fresh bruise spread down into the waist of his pants. Will asked, "Was the mother injured?"
"Scratches on the back of her arms and hands, like I said before. There's a pretty deep cut on the palm from the glass on the floor."
Leo cataloged.
"Lots of bruises, busted lips, some blood in her ear, maybe a sprained ankle. I thought it was broke, but she moved it."
He rubbed his mouth, probably wishing there was a cigarette in it.
"I called an ambulance, but she said she wasn't leaving until her daughter's removed."
"She said like that, removed?" Leo mumbled a curse under his breath as he pulled a spiral-bound notebook out of his pocket. He flipped to the right page and showed it to Will. Will frowned at the indecipherable scrawl. "Did you fingerprint a chicken?" Leo turned the notebook back around and read aloud, "I will not leave my daughter here. I am not leaving this house until Emma leaves." Will rolled the name around in his head, and the girl started to become a person to him rather than just another anonymous victim. She'd been a baby once. Her parents had held her, protected her, given her a name, and now they'd lost her. He asked, "What's the mother saying?" Leo flipped the notebook closed.
"Just the bare facts. I'd bet my left one she was a lawyer before she got knocked up and gave it all up for the good life."
"Why is that?"
"She's been real careful about what she says, how she says it. Lots of, I felt this and I feared that."
Will nodded. A plea of self-defense relied solely on a person's perception that he or she was in imminent danger of death at the time of the attack. Campano was obviously laying the groundwork, but Will didn't know if that was because she was smart or because she was telling the truth. He looked down at the dead man again. The blood-caked palms, the soaked shirt. There was more here than met the eye. Leo put his hand on Will's shoulder.
"Listen, I gotta warn you."
He stopped as the pocket door slid open. Amanda stood beside a young woman. Behind them, Will could see another woman sitting on a deep couch. She was wearing a white tennis outfit. What must have been her injured foot was propped up on the coffee table. Her tennis shoes were on the floor underneath.
"Special Agent Trent," Amanda said, sliding the doors closed behind her. "This is Detective Faith Mitchell."
Amanda looked Leo up and down like a bad piece of fish, then turned back to the woman.
"Special Agent Trent is at your disposal. The GBI is more than happy to offer you any and all help."
She raised an eyebrow at Will, letting him know that the opposite was true. Then, maybe because she thought he was stupid, she added,
"I need you back in the office within the hour."
The fact that Will had anticipated this very thing happening didn't make him any more prepared. His car was parked back at City Hall. Donnelly was going to be stuck on the scene until they cleared it, and any one of the beat cops outside would love a chance to get Will Trent alone in the back of a squad car.
"Agent Trent?"
Faith Mitchell seemed annoyed, which made Will think he'd missed something. He asked, "I'm sorry?"
"Yeah, you are,"
she mumbled. And Will could only blink, wondering what he had missed.
Leo didn't seem to find anything unusual about the exchange. He asked the woman, "The mother say anything?"
"The daughter's got a best friend."
Like Leo, Faith Mitchell carried a small spiral-bound notebook in her pocket. She paged through it to reference the name,
"Kayla Alexander. The mother says we can probably find her at school, Westfield Academy."
Will recognized the expensive private high school on the outskirts of Atlanta. Why wasn't Emma in school?
Faith answered Leo, though Will had asked the question.
There have been some truancy issues in the past.
Will was hardly an expert, but he couldn't imagine a teenage girl skipping school without taking her best friend along with her. Unless she was meeting her boyfriend. He looked at the stairs again, wishing that he could go up and examine the scene. Why wasn't the mom here today?
Faith said, she's got some weekly thing at her club. She usually doesn't get back until 3.
So if someone was watching the house, they'd know that Emma was here alone.
Faith told Leo, I need some air.
She walked out the door and stood at the edge of the porch with her hands on her hips. She was young, probably in her early 30s, of average height and pretty, in the way that thin blonde women were naturally thought to be pretty, but there was something that kept her from being attractive. Maybe it was the scowl that had been on her face, or the flash of raw hatred in her eyes. Leo mumbled an apology.
Sorry, man, I was trying to tell you.
Across the foyer, the pocket door slid open again. Abigail Campano stood at the entrance, leg bent at an angle so she wouldn't put weight on her hurt ankle. Unlike Faith, there was something radiant about her blonde hair and perfect milky white skin. Even though her eyes were swollen from crying, her lips still bleeding where it had been busted open, the woman was beautiful. Miss Campano, Will began.
Abigail, she softly interrupted. You're the agent from the GBI?
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to offer my condolences. She stared at him in confusion, probably because she still hadn't come to terms with her daughter's death. Can you tell me a little bit about your daughter? The blank stare did not go away. Will tried. You told Detective Donnelly that she'd been skipping school lately? She nodded slowly.
Obviously, she managed to.
Her voice trailed off as she looked at the dead man on the floor.
Kayla got her into skipping last year. She'd never done anything like that before. She was always a good girl, always trying to do the right thing.
There were other problems.
It all seems so inconsequential.
Her lips trembled as she held back her emotions.
She started talking back, doing her own thing. She was trying to be her own person, and we still wanted her to be our little girl.
Other than Kayla, did Emma have any friends? Boyfriends? Abigail shook her head, wrapping her arms around her waist.
She was so shy. She didn't make new friends easily. I don't know how this could have happened.
Does Kayla have a brother?
No, she's an only child.
Her voice caught.
Like Emma.
Do you think you could make a list of the other kids she hung out with?
There were acquaintances, but Emma always picked one person to...
Again, her voice trailed off.
She had no one but Kayla, really.
There was something to her tone that was so final, so certain about her daughter's aloneness in the world, that Will could not help but feel some of her sadness. He also hoped to God that Leo was making plans to talk to this Kayla. If she was as much an influence in Emma Campano's life as her mother indicated, then she probably knew a lot more about what had happened here today than anyone else did. Will asked Abigail, "Is there anyone who might have a grudge against you or your husband?" She kept shaking her head, transfixed by the sight of the dead man lying in her foyer.
"It all happened so fast. I keep trying to think what I did. What else I could have..."
"I know you've been asked this before, but are you sure you don't recognize the man?" Abigail's eyes closed, but he imagined that she could still see her daughter's murderer.
"No,"
she finally answered.
"He's a stranger to me."
Suddenly, there was a man screaming from the front of the house. "Get the fuck out of my way!" Will heard scuffling outside, cops yelling for someone to stop. Then Paul Campano barreled up the front steps like a man on fire. He rammed Faith Mitchell out of his way as he burst into the house. A uniformed patrolman caught her as she stumbled back, perilously close to the edge of the porch. Neither of them looked happy, but Leo waved his hand, telling them to let it go. Paul stood in the foyer, fists clenched. Will wondered if this was something genetic, that you were either the type of person who clenched your fists all the time or you weren't.
"Paul,"
Abigail whispered, rushing to him, even holding his wife. Paul kept his hands fisted. Faith was obviously still bristling. Her tone was clipped.
"Mr. Campano, I'm Detective Mitchell with the Atlanta Police Department. This is Detective Donnelly."
Paul wasn't interested in introductions. He was staring at the dead man over his wife's shoulder.
"Is that the fucker who did this?"
His voice turned to a growl. "Who is he? What's he doing in my house?" Faith and Leo exchanged a look that Will would have missed if he hadn't been watching them for his own cues. They were partners. They obviously had a shorthand, and it looked like this time Faith was taking the short straw. She suggested,
"Mr. Campano, let's go out on the porch and talk about this."
"Who the fuck are you?" Paul glared at Will, his beady eyes almost swallowed by the extra weight on his face. Will shouldn't have been surprised by the question, or even the way it was phrased. The last time Paul Campano had talked to him this way, Will was 10 years old, and they were both living in the Atlanta Children's Home. A lot had changed since then. Will had gotten taller and his hair had gotten darker. The only thing that changed about Paul was he seemed to have gotten heavier and meaner. Leo supplied,
"Mr. Campano, this is Agent Trent with the GBI.
Will tried to talk Paul down a little to make him feel like he could help. "Do you know if your daughter had any enemies, Mr. Campano?"
"Emma?"
he asked, glaring at Will.
"Of course not. She was only 17 years old.
How about you?"
"No,"
he snapped.
"No one who would do."
He shook his head, unable to complete the sentence. He looked back at the dead killer.
"Who is this bastard? What did Emma ever do to him?"
"Anything you can give us will help. Maybe you and your wife could—"
"She's up there, isn't she?"
Paul interrupted, looking up.
"My baby's upstairs."
No one answered him, but Leo took a couple of steps toward the stairs to block the way. Paul said,
"I want to see her."
"No,"
Abigail warned, her voice shaking. "You don't want to see her like that, Paul. You don't want to know."
"I need to see her."
"Listen to your wife, sir," Faith coaxed. "You'll get to see her soon. You just need to let us take care of her right now."
Paul barked at Leo,
"Get the fuck out of my way."
"Sir, I don't think—" Leo took the brunt of his anger. Paul slammed him into the wall as he bolted up the stairs. Will ran up after the man, almost knocking into him, as Paul stopped cold at the top of the landing. He stood frozen, staring at his daughter's lifeless form at the end of the hallway. The girl was at least 15 feet away, but her presence filled the space as if she were right there beside him. All the fight seemed to drain out of Paul. Like most bullies, he could never sustain any one emotion.
"Your wife was right," Will told him. "You don't want to see her like this."
Paul went quiet, his labored breathing the only audible noise. His hand was to his chest, palm flat as if he was saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Tears brimmed in his eyes. He swallowed hard. "There was this glass ball on the table." His voice had gone flat, lifeless. "We got it in Paris."
"That's nice," Will said, thinking that never in a million years could he imagine Paul in Paris.
"It's a mess up here."
"There are people who can clean it up for you."
He went silent again, and Will followed his gaze, taking in the scene. Leo was right about downstairs being worse than up. But there was something even more sinister and unsettling in the air up here. The same bloody shoe prints were here, crisscrossing the white carpeting up and down the long hall. Streaks of blood slashed across the white walls, where either the knife or a fist had arced over the body, repeatedly punching or plunging into the flesh. For some reason, the most troubling part to Will was the single red handprint on the wall directly over the victim's head, where her attacker had obviously rested his weight as he raped her.
"Trash can, right?"
Paul Campano wasn't looking for the garbage. He had called Will trash can when they were children. The memory put a lump in Will's throat. He had to swallow before he could answer.
"Yeah.
Tell me what happened to my daughter."
Will debated, but only for a moment. He had to turn sideways to get past Paul and go into the hallway, careful not to disturb